Thank you all so much for joining us. It's so wonderful to see so many smiling faces in this room and to have you all here to talk about something that, you know, I got to pick which session I emceed, and I picked this one because this is the one I need the most. And so I figure if I'm emceeing, I'll pay extra attention. But no, it really is something that I think about every day, is just trying to remind myself that perfection's not actually perfect, right? And trying to really be consistent in my thinking on that. And so I want to introduce our MC here, our moderator here, Mary Louise Philpott. And Mary Laura Philpott, sorry, I'm going to go back to my notes here, guys. And she is a writer on the overlap between the absurd and the profound, which just really jumped out to me because that's something we definitely need to write a lot more about, and is the author of I Miss You When I Blink, which has just come out. And the things that really jumped out at me about that is that identity crises don't just happen at midlife. We are all part of a continual identity crises or reinventions. And I think that's just so impactful as we think about, if we're not trying to always be perfect, how can we continually reinvent ourselves? So with that, Mary Laura, please join us on stage.
Thank you. Thank you. Be careful. Hi. All right, can everybody hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. You certainly may call me Mary Louise. You can call me whatever you want. This was my mother's decision to do the double name thing, so thanks for that, Mom. I'm so happy to be here, and I thought maybe what we could do just to start is a little bit of audience participation and just kind of go ahead and get our cards all out on the table. How many people in this room identify, if not as a perfectionist per se, somewhere on that type A end of the spectrum, like you like to get things right most of the time? Wow. Hello, friends. You are in the right room. So I have a reason for asking. Earlier this year, I published my memoir and essays. It's called I Miss You When I Blink. I'm not a celebrity. I haven't survived something extraordinary like a shipwreck or running away from a cult. I'm just a person, and I've lived through a lot of the same life phases that we all have. And I wrote this book to contribute to a genre that I call Guides to Surviving the Ordinary. And my hope is that it will start conversations. What I hope will happen is that people will read this, and they'll read about how I became a little baby perfectionist at a young age when I put together that when I did well in school, I got attention and approval. And I created this philosophy that if I could just get the right answers all the time and get 100 on every test life threw at me, I would always be happy. And I took that philosophy out into adulthood, where it served me really well until it really, really didn't. And I checked all the boxes on this imaginary to-do list of what I imagined was a successful, good, responsible adulthood, and when I got to the end of that list, I didn't feel like I had arrived anywhere. I felt lost and anxious and depressed. And so my hope is that people will read about that and feel inspired to talk to their friends and family about things they might want to change in their lives, and talk to them way earlier than I started talking to my friends and family about it. So it's a book about how my perfectionism almost derailed my life. But it's also a book about reinvention and how reinvention is possible at any age and at many ages and in small recurrent ways. So on that note, to set the tone for our conversation about that elusive creature, the happy perfectionist, I'm going to read to you from my book. And it's just a small section. It's maybe 72, 73 pages. It happens about this far in. And it's different from the rest of the book in that this piece does not tell a story. It's a direct address. It's a direct address to a certain kind of reader, and it's the kind of reader whose hand shot up before I even got the word perfectionist out of my mouth a minute ago. And if you don't personally relate to it, my hope is that it will help you understand someone else in your life. It's called A Letter to the Type A Person in Distress. Hi. Put down your phone and post-it notes for just a minute. I know you're busy rewriting your to-do list in your head, first chronologically, and then in order of task magnitude, and then visually like a pie chart with different colors according to how long each thing will take. But you can spare a minute. I just want to tell you, your outfit today is spot on. And not only does everyone find your appearance neat and visually pleasing, we all admire your words too. Your emails dance on the line between eloquence and candor. You have a real sense for when to go with bullet points instead of paragraphs. And you're always handy with an emoji or a culturally relevant movie clip. Some say there's no place for exclamation points anymore, but you intuit precisely when to employ that unexpected little punch, and it always delights your readers. The dinner you made for your book club last night had to have taken you hours to plan and execute. I know you left the packaging from the grocery store sponge cake out on the counter because you wanted to make your friends a strawberry shortcake they would love, but you also didn't want anyone to roll their eyes and call you a perfectionist for making everything from scratch. Did you use a vegetable peeler or a paring knife to get the sides of the cucumber to look like green and white peppermint stripes? That was a whimsical touch. I want you to know, I see your face when someone parks over the line in a crowded parking lot and inadvertently wastes a whole second space. And I know your scowl isn't really about the parking space. When you stop to pick up trash on a sidewalk or put the to-go menus back in their rack at the sandwich shop, you wish you didn't have to. You'd rather everyone else pull their weight, but if they won't, you will. Let's talk about work. You like having work to do, but it's hard for you to work sometimes alongside people who cut corners and blow off responsibilities. It feels like they're doing these things to spite you, like they slack off because they know you'll catch whatever balls they drop. You can't fathom how they can feel okay letting so many things remain half done. This leaves you in a constant state of simmering, low-grade resentment. And you feel guilty about occasionally having the urge to throw your laptop at someone's face. You wish these things didn't get to you. You want to live and let live. And I won't tell anybody, but I know you didn't really want to make the costumes for the Community Center Spring Musical. You don't even like Mary Poppins. But you filled out the feedback form after last year's play because that's what you're supposed to do if you attend, fill out the feedback form. And because you were so detailed, because that's what you should do, you should give details. If someone asks for your input, they asked you to do the costumes this year. And you said yes, because that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to give help when someone asks for it. And now you're stuck trying to figure out how to make Mary Poppins' dress fit around the cast on the young actor's broken arm. And you want the play to be great, but you wish you hadn't said yes. And you're mad that no one else said yes, and that the same people always end up doing everything. You wish you could take a break from carrying everything. It's all so heavy. You are so damn tired. I know. And I know you can't help it. I know that even if you wound the clock all the way back to the first time you can remember being this way, the moment you perceived that when you got things right, you got love. That when you achieved, you felt peace. That there'd probably still be no way to undo it. It's in your nature. It wouldn't matter if that moment or any other moment had happened differently. You see yourself the way you think the world sees you. So you value yourself when you are accomplishing and producing and finishing and succeeding. And if you can't value yourself, then there's no reason to get up every morning. And if there's no reason to get up, then what? It would be embarrassing to explain all that to someone, I know. It's awfully existential and weird to feel that if you get the punctuation wrong in a tweet, the world is a purposeless void. Not everyone gets it. So they don't get that if you worry that much over the little things, the big things seem so much bigger than they already are. It's bad enough wondering whether you've bought the right kind of sunscreen. Are you living the right life? Should you change paths? Go back to school? Stay together? Or break up? Are you being the right kind of daughter, parent, sister, friend. And I know that the more you do, the more it takes to feel like you've done enough. That's why you say sure to everything and sweat all the small stuff. Then you can be the person who gets the job done and saves the day, and then maybe you can rest. So, let me tell you. I approve of the organic lipstick in the eco-friendly tube that you used this morning because it's good for your skin and also good for the planet. I saw that you waited at the four-way stop until it was your turn. I noticed that you RSVP'd to the invitations in your inbox promptly. Good work. You nailed it. All of it. I know how much you need to hear this. I can never hear it enough. Thank you. Thank you for that woo. Okay, I am so thrilled to introduce this dream team panel. If you all want to make your way up to the stage, I'm so happy to be here with these people. They each have something unique and useful to add to the conversation about not letting our perfectionism get in the way of our happiness. Have a seat, doesn't matter where you are. I really love the idea that the fire marshal might come shut us down because there's just too much good stuff happening in this room. Too much confidence in one place. We'll start here. Emily.
Hi.
Emily Aries is not only a nationally recognized writer, but also the founder and author of Bossed Up, the book and the personal and professional development community. In the middle here, we have Kathy. Kathy Sanders heads up the, used to be the Southwest Resources Market, but now it's the Northeast Resources Market. She just moved to New York for Accenture, the company she has worked with for over three decades in leadership roles all over the world. And then here on the end, we have Inger Burnett Ziegler. She's an associate professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Northwestern University, also a clinical psychologist and a writer whose first book, Unbreakable, is due out in 2021. Congratulations on that. Okay. I think we'll start right here.
Sure.
Okay, so you write about how women thrive when the conditions for our success are clear.
Yes.
What about when they're not so clear, when it comes to being the advocate in your own life?
Yeah, I realized this not only, can y'all hear me? My mic hot? All right.
You're so hot.
I realized this not only through my own personal experience of navigating the transition a decade ago now from college to career, but the research bears this out as well, that when we have a syllabus, when we have a rubric for success, women as an aggregate part of the population, right, on the whole, outperform our male colleagues. We've been outperforming in terms of earning more undergraduate and graduate degrees than our male counterparts for 30 plus years. Something changes when the confines and clarity of academic success and the GPA striving, you know, A plus striving perfectionists enter the workforce, where perception is powerful. Perception becomes a part of our performance. And we all know that we're being perceived in a world that doesn't see us based on the content of our character alone. And so because the confines of academic life fall away and how we're being measured, how we're succeeding or not according to our peers, is seen through biased lenses, because we all carry unconscious bias, that can hold lots of people back based on not only gender, but race, creed, and all the other intersections of unconscious bias. Mm-hmm.
So
that
what
leads,
do we do about that?
I think that leads a lot of us to, for one, I burnt out before the age of 25. I've been in a rush my whole life, and I spent the first 3 years after graduation organizing as the youngest state director on the Obama campaign a decade ago now. And I was perfecting, performing, and pleasing everyone in my life every single day, overworking just from a sheer hours perspective or days per week perspective, but also trying to be the best girlfriend I could be, the best daughter I could be, and experiencing what social scientists call role overload, that feeling of being pulled in multiple directions over our limited time and resources. Personally, that led me to burnout and then need to unpack and uncover what burnout is, how it manifests, and how to prevent it. So inoculating ourselves from that trap, the perfectionist trap, that becomes a lot harder when how we're being graded is less clear.
Right.
First, starts with establishing your own metrics for success, your own internal measurements for success first.
How many people in this room miss getting report cards? Anybody? I miss having a piece of paper that tells me how well I am doing.
It's validating.
Yeah, it's very validating.
We have to find a way to provide internal validation.
Right.
Stop looking for external validation.
I love that idea of creating our own metrics and deciding for yourself without looking to somebody else and without comparing to somebody else what your success
metrics
are.
You can give yourself a gold star.
Yeah. Inger, we know that women, particularly women of color, are more likely to experience imposter syndrome, something with which I am very, very familiar. How can women recognize when they are falling into imposter syndrome, and what do we do to combat that?
Yeah, you know, imposter syndrome is really when we are doubting our right to belong somewhere. We show up in a space that's new, that's different. Perhaps we have a new opportunity. Perhaps we're starting a new job or school, and we wonder if we have a right to be there. And I think the first step in really combating the imposter syndrome is telling yourself, yes, I do have a right to be here. I belong here. And telling yourself that even when there are other people in the space that may be giving you messages that you don't belong. Maybe you're the only, right, if you're a woman of color. Maybe you're the first in your family to embark upon such an experience or opportunity. And other people may question, well, why is this person at the table? So just starting by reminding yourself, yes, I have a right to be there. And then secondly, you know, reminding yourself of all of the things that you did to get to that particular space. The work, the grind, the hustle, the productivity, the perseverance, the grit. Telling yourself that, making a list if necessary. And then combating the yeah, but person, right? How many of us know the yeah, but person, right? I have a lot of yeah, but myself, right? The person that says, yeah, these are all the reasons that I got to this place, but they don't know about da-da-da-da. Or, well, somebody put me up for this, so it doesn't really count, right? Leaning into the yeah and rejecting the but, right?
That's good.
And then finally, I would say, you know, being aware of that mental chatter, right? Sometimes we can become so attached to the mental chatter that it becomes kind of ingrained in our being, and we take it on as truth rather than just mental chatter. So recognizing when you're getting caught up in that mental chatter and saying, ah, that's just my mind doing that thing again. I do belong. These are the reasons why I belong. And leaning into the yeah, rejecting the but.
I'm picking up a theme here so far on finding validation within yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Rather than waiting for someone to give you permission.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes the world won't.
I think
we need to acknowledge that all the hard work and grit and preparation in the world would work if we lived in a just world. But we don't. So I think it's really important to set realistic expectations that we don't live in a perfect meritocracy.
Right.
Injustice is everywhere.
And be ready to give ourselves that permission.
Yeah, and be ready to say, maybe it's not me. Like, maybe I did everything I could do. Maybe I did the best I could with this opportunity and what I could do to prepare.
Right.
Maybe the feedback I'm getting, like, well, could you be a little less intense? Or has anyone been called aggressive? Yeah, for like trying hard, sorry, should I try less? You know, like when we get that kind of feedback, which I hear from women every single day, that, you know, if I could just tone it down a little with the clients, that would be great. You know, when we get feedback like that, we have to parse between what is true that I should internalize as something I might be able to work on and change, and what can I reject as part of someone else's problem that they're projecting on me, or society's problem writ large with powerful women, and especially powerful women of color.
Right. Speaking of meritocracy, Kathy, you didn't get where you are at Accenture without having very high standards for excellence. How does that affect your relationships with your colleagues, And then as an add-on to that, how does it affect your relationships with other people in your life, in your personal life?
So, first of all, thank you for saying high standards as opposed to perfectionist, because yeah. there is no perfection here, I gotta tell you. In fact, right before we came in, we had a little sign down there that said, the happy perfectionist, and I took a picture of it with an empty chair behind it. Sent it to my husband and said, must be missing in action, I don't know. Purple unicorn. But I do think that, you know, having high standards in a workplace, you're talking about how other people tell you to tone down. I'm would like to kind of focus on how you tell other people to bring it up.
Yeah.
And so, you know, can having high standards impact your relationships with people at work? About 30 years ago, I had worked on a presentation. It was probably the first presentation that I was going to make to a client, and I was really excited, and I'd worked on it all weekend. Sunday night, the partner comes in to review it with me, and he said, really? Is this the best we can do? Because if this is the best we can do, we can put our pencils down right now and go home.
Cool. I'm sweating.
Motivating or not motivating? I mean, I decided to man up, if you will, woman up, and took it on board. I mean, here's 30-something years later, and I remember it, right? Mm-hmm. And yet, I think, okay, what could he have said? How could he have phrased the question? He could have said, is this the best you can do? And then I probably would have gone home. But he said, is this the best we can do? Mm-hmm. But think, instead, what if he had said, this is really good work. However, I think we can make it even better. So I think we need to think about our words and actions. They matter as we want to impart our standards on others.
Yeah.
Now, I took one of those tests. You know, we're always getting our social styles and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. So I was kind of voted a driver at work, funny enough. And I go home, and I'm sharing this with my, at the time, teenage kids and my husband. I said, you know, well, I get why people think that, but isn't it really good that I come home and I'm really laid back?
What did he say?
My daughter was like in high school taking one of her first psychology courses, and yeah. she says, me, she goes, you know, self-awareness is a really good thing. In the way like only a 15-year-old can, well, self-awareness is a really good thing. Maybe you ought to get some. So I've just
decided.
Yeah,
you want feedback, ask a teenager.
Yeah, I decided just to own it. This is who I am. Mm-hmm.
Mm. Words are powerful, as you say. And to get back to your point, Inger, about that inner narration, we are more persuasive than we know we are, even with ourselves. Mm. And one thing that I have found, when I can't interrupt and stop my inner narration and it's going to a dark place, I will turn on a guided meditation. I've downloaded the Calm app, which I am in love with. I've also used Buddhify. There are several great guided meditation apps. But if I can't replace that narration with my own more positive narration, I let somebody else do it for me. Put in headphones and let that nice lady on the Calm app repeat those positive things for me. Kathy, I want to follow up with something else. If you're at work and you are striving for excellence, but the people around you are not, let's say they are not so much type A as type B or C or D, how do you motivate them?
You know, motivation is getting people to do something, and then obviously there's the recognition side of it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think both of these play on each other. You do things when you've been motivated, and then somebody says thank you, you know, recognizes it. So one of the things I've been thinking a lot about recently is how do we recognize other people? At Accenture, we love our surveys. And so one of our engagement surveys says people are engaged and motivated when they feel recognized, when they feel they've got three or more advocates in the workplace. So you think, this is pretty simple. Well, this is a metric we don't nail very well. So I started talking to all my colleagues. Well, I'd be on conference calls or whatever, and I'd say, okay, tell me, how many of you have recognized a colleague in the last 7 days? And it would always be 80, 90% say, absolutely. And then I would turn the question around. How many of you feel like you've been recognized by a colleague in the workplace in the last 7 days? Maybe 20%, maybe 30%.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're all doing this recognition, but we're not getting it, where's it going?
Right, something's not adding up there.
Yeah, like, you've got the best praised kids in the world. Like, where's all this recognition going? And so it's really how you hear it. And we started talking about, what do you hear? Mm. How do you like to hear it? Some people want a public shout out, right? No. nice blouse. I'll give you that public boots. And that skirt right there, that's cool.
It is.
Yeah, it is. So some people really like that public shout out. Some people just want that, you and me. I'm just right, we're in a meeting, but I'm, well said. And that's all it takes. Some people like the handwritten note. Mm-hmm. So learning the people you're working with and what motivates them and how they feel recognized, how they get that affirmation. Because it's not going to come in a report card.
Right. If I could just add briefly to that, I love what you said. And in addition, sometimes we get the feedback, we get the affirmation, and we don't hear it.
Exactly.
Right? So often when I'm working with people, it's to open your landscape to see what positive feedback you're getting from your universe that maybe you're discounting mm-hmm. or minimizing or throwing out of the door.
I love having a clinical psychologist in the room with us right now.
Help us break it down.
How do can you, I add one quick yeah, thing? Do. Just a quick plug for a book by Sheila Heen, who's at Harvard. She wrote a book called Thanks for the Feedback. And I interviewed her on my podcast, the Bossed Up Podcast. And what I love about her message is that it reframes feedback as something that you should hope for and wait for, but instead something you should actively seek out and how to seek out the feedback that you actually need to thrive and grow. So I think taking responsibility for not only hearing it, but asking for it, seeking it out is a part of how when you're younger in the workforce and might not be in a managerial position, that's another way to think about your learning and growth as the agent of change in your own career.
As long as it's in moderation and not every 10 minutes, how am I doing?
Right.
How am
right.
I doing?
Yeah,
right. Doing?
Tell me I'm good. Tell me I'm good. Tell me I'm good. Right? Like, that's really not what it's about.
Right. That's a great point. That worry and anxiety that comes with perfectionism, because when you are, you know, whether we use the word perfectionist or not, when you are someone who is always striving for that finish line that seems to keep moving, you're always aware of what you haven't achieved or what's not working. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to use you for free therapy here. How do we manage that worry and that anxiety that seems to be ever present? Do you have tips for us?
Yeah, I love how you started this session talking about the relationship between being a perfectionist and getting affirmation from people that we love and how that can be a message that we learn at a really early age. I can think back on being in third grade and getting, 97% on a test and my dad being like, what happened to the other 3%? Right? And that really setting the stage. It's a small example, but those little examples kind of show up and they keep us kind of hungering for that perfection, the little bit that's left. It keeps us hungering for the praise of people that are close to us. And sometimes it can also lead to us feeling like we're not enough, right? That what we've done isn't enough. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, perfectionism is often closely attached to worry, right? Worry about not only the product of our work, but also worry about how other people see us, how other people will see us if we're not perfect, if our work is not perfect, and also in turn how we see ourselves, right? What does it mean to me now that I only got 97% on the test, right? And it just doesn't feel good. It just doesn't feel good to worry all the time. It doesn't feel good in your...
Oh, get that mic up there.
In? Yes?
Yes.
There you go.
Okay. Trying to manage the feedback, but it doesn't feel good in your body, right? And when I'm nervous, it shows up in my stomach, it shows up in sleeplessness, right? It doesn't feel, you might, have a stiff neck or back or that type of thing. It makes your work less enjoyable because rather than doing the thing that you're so excited about doing, you're worried about doing the thing. So I think, when thinking about how to manage that, the first step is really monitoring your expectations. And I love how you framed the stage about feedback. Feedback is a gift.
It is a gift.
And not letting perfect be the enemy of good. And I know it's kind of a cliche statement, but I think that is very true, that 97% is good. I will own that.
97% is awesome.
I want to make sure everyone can hear her. Is there something we can do to improve this mic?
Oh.
Should we turn off the podium mic? Nope. Okay. I just want to make sure you're being heard. Can everyone hear her in the back? Can we swap a mic out, maybe?
I think
hold it closer.
She's just saying some really great stuff. I want to make sure everyone hears from the doctor.
Am I good? Yes?
Thank you so much.
No.
Oh, thank you. She's switching it.
Yeah.
There you go.
Thank you.
All right. Good now? No.
She's got to get back there.
She's got to turn it on.
Thank you, tech. Right. Snaps for tech.
Yay.
Mic check? Okay.
Mic check?
Hey.
Good?
Good.
All
right.
That's a growth mindset.
Thank
moment.
You.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. So managing your expectations, right? Managing the expectations and, you know, being aware of the difference between expectations that you're putting on yourself versus expectations that are coming from your environment. Doing what you can, doing it well, doing it fully, and then letting it go, releasing it into the world. And then, you know, inviting yourself back to the now. I love that you mentioned the calm app. I'm a big proponent of mindfulness because mindfulness really is teaching us to be present in the now. And anxiety, worry, perfectionism is often rooted in future worry, worrying about that bad thing that may or may not happen down the line. And when we're doing that, we're letting go of the moment that's happening right now and also letting go of our opportunity to be great right now. Right? And so just constantly bringing yourself back to the now.
Speaking of mindfulness, one of the things that I have found helpful for me as a perfectionist and as someone who lives for the high that I get in crossing something off my to-do list is to put healthy things on my to-do list. So if I have a day planner that has 8 lines on it for a day, don't use all 8 lines for work things. At least 2 or 3 of those lines need to be for things that feed my soul and feed my energy and energize me, like walk the dog, take a shower. I mean, take a shower. It's a dumb thing to put on a list, but it's also awesome.
Yeah.
I remember that the year when my son was born, I switched from working full-time to working freelance, to writing freelance. And so I had this very abrupt stop in productivity and in the rewards of full-time work. And I remember walking into my kitchen when he was just a few weeks old and putting him in the bassinet and finding my day planner under all the unopened mail and opening it up and writing, take shower, in the shaky handwriting. And I went and took a shower and walked back in with my hair dripping wet and crossed it out. And it felt so good.
That's awesome.
I didn't even tell you that I was bringing this up.
It's beautiful.
But I have to talk about planners for a second.
And I want you to talk about growth mindset, too.
Yeah,
you mentioned that a second
ago. I do. I'm sort of going off script here, y'all. What I love about what you just addressed is that there's research that backs up why that works. It's known as the progress principle. And the simple act of giving yourself the sensation of forward momentum is inherently motivating. So it's kind of like getting a punch card for a free car wash after 10 car washes with 2 holes already punched in it. There's social science that shows if you give yourself the sensation of a head start, you're more likely to come back and punch the rest of those cards.
Oh, yeah.
I created what I call the Bossed Up Life Tracker Planner. I know it's planner season, y'all. This is our 2019 edition. And what we actually came up with was a methodology that I've tested now for 6 going on 7 years amongst hundreds of women in our community who at the top of every month set intentions that aren't just about work, that are about wellness, love and relationships, and other goals in our lives for creativity or financial goals or travel goals. And then we set proactively our priorities beyond the deliverables that we know are expected of us at work. And the psychology of being in that proactive mindset and being the agent, the driver, the boss of your everyday leaves you more likely to get the things that are important to you done, not just the things that are urgent done.
You feel like you're making progress.
Yeah.
Talk about the growth mindset. I know we've all read a lot about that, but why is that so important, especially for people who have perfectionistic tendencies?
The biggest difference between growth mindset and fixed mindset, which goes back to Carol Dweck's groundbreaking research, and if you really want to get to know mindset, go to the OG of mindset, Carol Dweck. and read her book from, I think, the 80s or 70s. She studied...
Why did you look at me when you said...
No.
They're very relevant.
I was, like, validating, like, is that right? That date's right, right? Sorry. 80s are back with a vengeance, and so should Carol Dweck's research. So it all boils down to whether you get feedback, like Dr. Inger did, about, you know, why wasn't the 3%, a 97%, 100%? What happened there, which is in some ways motivating, but in other ways, it basically asks you, well, aren't you smart? Because a smart person gets a 97 or 100% on their test. Instead of looking at, well, wow, you must have put in a lot of effort. You must have studied a lot for that. Mm-hmm. It basically says, I'm not good or bad. I'm not smart or dumb. I'm not someone who belongs or doesn't belong. I am a work in progress. And in order for us to continually seek out the risk-taking opportunities that actually lead to growth, we have to detach our self-worth from our work, from our outcomes.
Yep.
So say it with me. Put your hand on your heart right now. Repeat after me. My work.
My work.
Is not.
Is not.
My worth.
My worth.
One more time for good measure. My work.
My work.
Is not.
Is not.
My worth.
My worth.
And the shift. Yeah, right? We're in church, apparently. So the shift in thinking that my outcome does not reflect whether I'm good or bad turns you from saying, tell me I'm good, validate me, from that risk-averse mindset to someone who says, I'm 26 years old and I only took one econ class in college. I don't know if starting my own business is going to work. I don't know if quitting politics and taking what I learned from organizing and starting my own career community is going to be viable if I can pay my bills in 3 months from now. But I'm not going to let that unknown stop me from trying.
Yes. And stop you from, this is a point I like to make a lot, in addition to don't let things stop you from trying, don't let that perfectionistic mindset stop you from quitting sometimes. If you are someone who is driven by this search for excellence, sometimes you feel like everything you start, you must finish.
Yes.
And it's not finished unless you have reached the highest possible level in that thing. But it is just as important and strategic a decision to decide what you won't have in your life as what you will. So periodically, and I, in talking with friends about this over many glasses of wine, I've unscientifically decided that it's roughly every 3 to 5 years. Every 3 to 5 years after we get out of school, and apparently for the rest of our lives, it's time to take stock and remove a few things from our lives in order to make time and space for the things that really have meaning.
Kathy, I used to describe that as, what are you going to get a B in?
Right.
In order to get an A in everything else.
Right.
And I had some women who I would say that to, especially right out of school, who would be like,
nothing.
No. I don't want to choose. But the difference between proactively saying I'm aiming for a B in my fitness right now so I can get an A in finishing my book versus trying to get an A in like going to the gym 4 times a week and finishing your manuscript means that at the end, when you fail inevitably to reach your perfection goals, your perfectionistic expectations, you feel retrospectively like a failure instead of actively with the agency and proactivity choosing what you want to deprioritize.
Right. There's a fantastic book out right now by Lisa Damore. She wrote Untangled, but her new book is called Under Pressure. And she writes about how girls in particular in high-achieving, high-stress academic situations tend to shoot for the highest possible level and not settle for anything else, and how that can be a great thing, but it also leads to great stress and great anxiety. And she actually proposes this this sort of parenting strategy that I think is genius. She says in her practice, and she's a psychologist in an all-girls school, and I think she also talks to families who have boys and girls, she sees often that what boys will do in school is kind of calculate, all right, I have an exam coming up. What do I need to make on that exam? What's the lowest I could make on that exam and still get an A in the class? An 83? All right, I'm aiming for an 83. The girls...
I'm all in.
I love that. The girls are like, I have an A in that class. What's the highest I could get on the exam to get like 100 plus in this class? And she actually advocates teaching our daughters to adopt that strategy of looking across the board and going, where are some places where I could aim just a bit lower and come out fine and take a little of that stress off myself. It's a really interesting read. I highly recommend it.
I love that you mentioned that. I love that this panel is bringing in relevant research. There's a similar line of research that looks at the difference between men and women in terms of their confidence in putting themselves up for new opportunities, like employment opportunities, where the women will often more commonly say, I'm not qualified, I don't have the expertise.
It happens every day.
And the man will just be like, I'll do it. Yeah. And by nature of the percentage of the time that they're more willing to put their hat in the ring in order to be considered mm-hmm. for an mm-hmm. opportunity, they're more likely to get it. And so just thinking about what you lean into and where that self-doubt keeps you from actually even allowing yourself an opportunity to have a chance.
At the risk of sounding slightly contrarian, I just want to offer a different perspective of viewing that same outcome, which is there's a lot of research. This one little internal study that Hewlett-Packard did like 15, 20 years ago that says women only apply when they meet 100% of their requirements and men apply when they meet about 60%. First of all, I think that study was never done in a scientific way, even though there are other items in the research that replicate that result. But part of the findings upon further investigation is that women believe in following the rules mm-hmm. to a higher degree than men do. So it's not just about us having more confidence. It behooves us to acknowledge that employers have responsibility to make very clear what is required in this job description and what would be nice to have. So differentiating between required background skills and recommended experiences actually levels the playing field in a more structural way, so it doesn't just hope that we're all more confident, because as it turns out, unconscious gender bias comes into play here too, mm-hmm. because men are more often promoted based on potential alone, and women are more often promoted only based off of past performance. And it's not because we lack confidence. It's because the world sees women's potential in a really unfair way.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
That's that on that. Just wanted to acknowledge that as another way of viewing the same outcome.
Kathy, when we were on our planning call for this panel, you mentioned an interesting question, and I would love for all of us to do kind of a lightning round of responses mm-hmm. to this, and I'll start with you. If you could give one piece of advice to your, let's say, 30-year-old, but it could be younger, yourself at a younger age, what would it be?
Well, since most of my research is done in the field at home, I'll relate another conversation I had with my two daughters, and they were probably 9 and 11, and we were out having a pizza night. I remember it so vividly. And we were talking about, well, what might you be when you grow up? Just what are the possibilities? And my oldest daughter, doesn't fall far from the tree, says, well, I might do a lot of things, but I think that no matter what I do, as long as I'm giving it my very best, I'm the very best at whatever I choose. And I was like, that's my girl. That's my girl. My youngest daughter says, interesting, but I have a different approach. You know, I am who I am, and no matter what I do, there's always going to be somebody who's better than me, and there's always going to be somebody who's worse. So why do I have to be anything other than who I am?
How old is she?
Second children.
I was like, what she said.
Yeah.
That's profound.
So, and
they've grown up in these two paths, and you know, like we were three people that were marching to a very regimented band, and this one wasn't off to another drummer. She's like listening to punk, literally, you know. Like, so interesting family dynamic. And now, I mean, they're in their 30s now, and I look at the paths, and I see so clearly that we're still on these paths. And it makes an interesting family dynamic.
Yeah.
But I think as we think about the choices we make and the mindset we have when we make them, and we talk a lot, you hear the word authentic a lot. Well, what is authentic? But authentic is knowing that inner voice. What does it tell you to do? Mm-hmm. And if she says, by the way, the one who says it doesn't matter, she's now a dog trainer. Okay? She found her passion in life in her 30s, and she's all in it, and we're supportive. This one works for the State Department in Norway. So, you know.
There's something for everyone.
There's something for everyone. But I think just listening and knowing your place and what you aspire to and following that, my dream doesn't have to be yours or yours.
Yep.
It's okay.
Yeah. Inger, what about you?
Mine is brief. And I picked it up. I stole it from a yoga teacher that I had the privilege of practicing with earlier this summer, who started our practice with the mantra of, you are loved and you are enough. And I think for women who can get stuck in the cycle of self-doubt, of kind of deprecation, of questioning, of worry, of perfectionism, just reminding yourself of that at 20, mm-hmm. 12, 40, mm-hmm. wherever you are on this spectrum, of you are loved and you are enough, certainly is helpful for me.
Emily, briefly.
First of all, shout out to therapy. That's also
everybody
the
do therapy.
That's the answer to every question we've discussed today as well. The advice I would give a younger me is actually a piece of advice that did come to me at one point in the form of a fortune cookie. If you can believe it, I still have this little piece of paper. And it said, you deserve to serve and to be served. You deserve to serve and to be served. And that hit me really deeply because I struggled for a long time with what I call in the first chapter of my book, the martyrdom mindset, mm-hmm. which I define as this idea that success requires suffering. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that way? Like, is that underlying your assumptions? If it's not hard, it's not worth getting. Mm-hmm. That is baked into not only how we are socialized as women, but specifically into the American ideology, right? The Protestant work ethic, idle hands are the devil's workshop. That was literally this idea that leisure yep. equals evil. And so my mother, a labor and delivery nurse who works 12-hour shifts on her feet to this day, who raised 4 great children, if I do say so myself, 5 if you count my dad, who on every single vacation day that she gets, she lumps her vacation days together and over the past decade has started a medical mission nonprofit in Dommery, Haiti, one of the most remote parts of the country. My mom has martyred herself for the people she loves, from her patients to her family to the people she serves. And she is an incredibly powerful woman who is undervalued in our society from a pay perspective for all of that labor. But I also had to give myself permission to iterate mm-hmm. on that role. I think every woman is handed a script from the women who come before us. And it is up to us to give ourselves permission to redline it.
Yeah.
And say, I'm going to replicate this quality of my mother, and I'm going to change this.
In my own way.
In my own way.
The thing I always love to say is something I learned from my producer and cameraman on a show that I do for Nashville Public Television called The Word on Words, where I interview other writers. When I mess up, which I do all the time, he will lean out from behind his camera and go, try it again more like you. When I get really like stiff and robotic because there's a camera on me and I'm talking in this weird voice, he'll say, try it again more like you. And I tell myself that all the time, and I wish I could go back and tell myself that when I was 25. Try it again more like you. It is okay to quit. It is okay to start over. I think we're about ready for some Q&A. Can you get up on the stage safely from here? Can we help you?
Yeah.
And I don't know if we have microphones in the audience, or if not, we'll just repeat your questions. But I'm going to turn this part over to you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great job. Thanks.
Lovely job, ladies. It was...
Lovely job, ladies. Thank you so much. I took so many notes, and I can't wait to start implementing these things. We do have a few minutes for questions here, so if you will raise your hand, this nice gentleman here will bring over the microphone. See one over here in the back? on the left.
There's photos happening right now. I want to be like.
It's the blue. Left.
It must be. It's the cheetah on cheetah.
That's right.
Would you stand up?
Yes. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah. Can you stand up so we can see you? Thank you.
Yes?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
First of all, thank you guys very much. Really, really appreciated the passage that you read from your book. I was getting a little teary-eyed over here listening to that. So that was beautiful. The question I have for you guys is I'm very lucky in that I work with a lot of powerful, maybe not fully perfectionistic, but type A women. I'm very lucky. I get to learn from a lot of very different women every day. But I would love to get some advice from you guys on how we take that type A tendency of out of ourselves to be competitive, out, and maybe bring each other up more and stop trying to, I need to be the best out of the type A women I work with, right? That's my tendency, because I want to be the best at what I do. But there's a lot of really great women who are just as perfectionistic as I am. How do I become an ally to them and make them my ally instead of competing against each other?
Please do. All boats rise. You know, if you have an abundance mentality set, if you help them and they help you, all boats rise. It's not a win-lose. But some people are wired to think it has to be a win-lose. If you're just inherently wired that way, own it. Don't try to be something you're not. But if you really think, could we do more if we all rise up together? I've got women that have come ahead of me in the workplace for 30 years, and I've got people who have gone beyond me that used to work for me. Celebrate it. Really admire their qualities. And I'm sure everybody knows the Madeleine Albright quote.
Yeah.
There's a special place in hell for women who don't support other women. that one's gonna go, that's gonna keep me on the good and narrow. No, it we're all competitive, right? We are type A people. But it is that, can I get myself into, and I do, this is kind of what I tell myself every morning. It's not win or lose. Growing a business, we all win when everybody has an abundance mentality.
Good. Any other questions? Over here.
Hi, ladies. Am I audible?
I can hear you.
Right, so very informative talk. It was fun listening to you ladies. And what I learned was that with perfectionism comes the worrying and the questioning, which I agree to. But then I feel there's another perspective to perfectionism when you expect it from another person. A very basic example, you know, humans are trying to reach Mars. There is no way you're going to get there without being perfect. When I walk into a surgery room for myself or my loved ones, I would not want anybody less than perfect to lay a finger on me. So, you know, no matter how much we say that, don't worry about it, 97% may be good in third grade, but then there are areas in life where we need that 100%. What do you have to say about that?
So I'll just make a brief response to this and challenge the notion that perfectionism even exists. And even though you think that surgeon may be at 100%,
and then one thing
he or she is not perfect. And the more that we can allow ourselves some grace for that and recognize that we're not the only ones missing that 3%, that's true for everyone around us, I think that we can become more compassionate toward ourselves and others and move into a space of more realistic expectation.
Maybe there's a reason why the medical community has one of the highest rates of alcoholism and depression, and doctors in particular and surgeons in particular, like that expectation of perfection and guaranteeing that for every patient, which is of course what every doctor wants to do, can actually result in some really unhealthy behaviors and unhealthy internalized beliefs. And our system is set up in a lot of ways to demand perfectionism, demand perfect, but over the long haul. I would say look at it as a short-term sprint versus what is a sustainable form of success. I can expect my doctor to be perfect, but if I expect them to be perfect in 12-hour shifts, during, like, anyone here gone through the medical school process? Like, during, after medical school, when you're in the hospital for 12 hours or sometimes 18 hours, or you're a pilot, like, there's a reason we need to protect workers. There's a reason I want my doctor to show up well rested and not on hour 11 of a 15-hour shift where they haven't had a chance to eat lunch. So let's bring a human approach to work so we can expect perfection as long as we get lunch and rest and our basic needs met. I think we've actually lost our way when it comes to establishing our hierarchy of needs and expecting people to demand perfection without baseline levels of human needs being met first. So I see it as a systemic problem in how America especially views work and what is a sustainable form of success.
And one of the things that didn't come up in this, we talk about, I'm working at IBM, is this idea of agile, right, and continually getting a little bit better.
Or allowing for, because when we went to the moon, it wasn't perfect.
Right.
But there was improvisation and innovation that happened every step of the way. So as long as you're continuing in an agile way, whatever methodology you want to use, that constant, it's not going the way I want it to. What do I do now? Sometimes it didn't come in the rule book and it didn't come on the syllabus.
And sometimes people die, right, in those iterations. Like, I don't want to gloss over the seriousness underlying your question. Like, we all know Apollo 11, right? Like, people died in that iterative process. It's not really a joke, right? Like, getting better and being agile is not a light or easy thing to do. It takes
very challenging
risk. And sometimes that risk is human life.
I think we have time for one more question. Yeah, right over here.
Oh, she already has the mic. Oh.
So is this on? Okay. I'm very much a perfectionist in almost every area of my life. And recently I have seen it start to rub off on my 4-year-old. What sort of advice do you have for us as mothers so that we can build up our children and not, you know, be the hard, everything needs to be perfect sort of mindset?
All I can offer to you, I'm a mom of 2. Both of my children are teenagers now, and they are 2 very different people. I have one who is like, came out of my brain with this same very type A tendency, and then I have one who is so the other way that sometimes I'm like, could you be a little bit perfectionist? I would say, first of all, free yourself from the pressure to think that the way you mother your children is going to determine exactly who they are. Because a lot of that is going to come out from just who they are. So don't wake up every day going, oh my God, how I serve the breakfast is going to determine their psyche for the rest of their life. But beyond that, all you can do is model. Model failing and learning from it. I try when I screw things up at home, which I do all the time, to sort of narrate out loud what's happening. Like, oh, whoa, I just put those walnuts into toast for our salad and they caught fire. That happens sometimes. And you know what? Now I'm going to start over. And I start over. So modeling, maybe.
Self-compassion. Modeling that self-compassion.
Yeah. And apologizing when you're wrong. Because sometimes...
Yeah. Apologies sometimes go a long way.
And I would say, if you can, just say the equivalent of, it's so nice to see you. I mean, you probably, some of us have parents that you would say, it's so nice to see you, but you're too fat, too thin, you don't have enough makeup on, you have too much makeup on, but there's always the but. It's nice to see you, but, or and. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's just nice to see you, period.
That's a nice thing to end on.
Any other burning questions we can take quickly here? Oh, one more right there.
I think lady with red hair gets a chance to ask a question.
I'm loving this hair.
I know. If you've got the courage to have that hair, you could ask any question you want.
I love it.
And we will make this very, very brief, ladies.
Okay. You guys talked about role overload and burnout.
You talked about role overload and burnout.
You talked about role overload and burnout and tips to prevent it. What if you're already there, and how do you deal with that? And then one of the other things was internal validation. Can you actually speak to specific tips if you are currently experiencing external validation and you want to start working on internal validation?
What's a quick answer?
Okay, buy my book, seriously. That is what my whole book is about. And my podcast on Tuesday was about how to recover from a toxic workplace.
I'll quickly say about internal validation. I would start by asking yourself the question, what am I doing well right now? And being okay with naming things that are really small. Like, I got here to this beautiful conference with these beautiful women today, you know. I enjoyed a lovely meal with my child
or my spouse. And just thinking of those things for yourself and resisting the urge to constantly look for those pieces of information from other people. Oftentimes we're wondering what other people think. And so when I talk with people, I often say, well, what do you think? Right? What do you think about yourself right now in this moment?
So for any follow-up questions, where these ladies are headed to a book signing, invite you to join them. Thank you all so much for your time today.